Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And of course, as you know, we tape our show via Zoom on Monday, so if something should happen on Monday night, we're not going to be talking about it. But as we begin every show, with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman in the fall of 2019 during the impeachment hearings. But I'm going to do a little preface to this conversation. So I happened to grab Forbes magazine this morning, and sure enough, here's what they posted on Facebook. Here's all the top officials Trump has removed since his impeachment. And of course, they were starting out with the most recent one, which is the State Department Inspector General, Steve Linnick, who was removed on Friday. And then they went through the list. And they pointed out that on May 1st, Trump ousted Acting Health and Human Services Inspector General Christy Grimm after she filed a report finding severe shortages at hospitals combating coronavirus. On April 7th, Trump removed Acting Defense Department Inspector General Glenn Fine, who was set to oversee the Trump administration's handling of the new $2 trillion coronavirus stimulus package. On April 3rd, 2020, Trump fired Inspector General Mike Atkinson, whose decision to share a whistleblower's complaint with Congress about Trump's Ukraine dealings jump-started last fall's impeachment proceeding. Ah, but why am I reading this? Because on February 7th, 2020, Trump canned European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland and National Security Council member Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, both witnesses in Trump's impeachment trial just 2 days after Trump's acquittal. So everyone, as the warm-up act, I want to remind you, you will hear the words of Colonel Vindman. You're going to hear Lieutenant Colonel Vindman every day in between now and November. Keep these words, and maybe we'll throw in some words of the other inspector generals he's fired, in your head when you vote in November. Now, Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I'm at theconversation.com. You know it's my favorite place to go. I love it. I mine it all the time. And a little history, which is why this is both an important story for me personally. It's an important story for us nationally. But it actually even relates to a mini Betsy DeVos that we have in the state of New Hampshire. The title of the piece was Giving Private Schools Federal Emergency Funds Slated for Low-Income Students Will Shortchange At-Risk Kids. And what folks don't know outside of the state of New Hampshire is that we have a mini Betsy DeVos. Am I right, Ken? Frank Edelblut is Betsy in pants. There's just no question.
I don't know who's worse.
He's homeschooled his kids. He's never went to public school. He's never been a teacher. He's incredibly wealthy. I mean, if you didn't know it and I just described it and didn't give you the gender, you would think I was describing Betsy DeVos. But unfortunately, it is not Betsy DeVos. It is the head of our Commissioner of Education, Frank Edelblut. So as I
saw this, he's trying to funnel state money, state public school money, to students in private schools for
special
programs for
exactly,
the private school
exactly.
students.
So before I read this, we know he's been trying to it. Now he must be in his glory because Betsy has said, go for it. Joining us right now is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina. Derek Black is now joining us. He is involved in a lot of litigation, a lot of issues around the issue of education and public education. So he is a huge Encyclopedia Britannica of knowledge when it comes to this. And I have to tell you, Derek, as I'm reading it, I'm making phone calls. Did you know this? Have you calculated it for New Hampshire? Vermont, did you know this? I was so upset because as I read your headline, it wasn't even as potent as your story, because your story is even more frustrating about what Betsy is doing, which appears to fly in the face of everything, which was the rationale for putting the money into the CARES Act. So first, let me welcome you to the program. And then I want you to explain to my audience what was in the CARES Act, why they were concerned about public schools, and then because Betsy DeVos gets to put her finger on a lot of these things, she then distorts the intent. And of course, we were just saying at one point that there is one person that a lot of people would like to see removed, and it's not an inspector general. It happens to be a woman involved in education named Betsy DeVos. And when you realize what she's out to do, she's really out to dismantle and destroy public education. So let me welcome you to the program. And then I would love to have you walk through the origination of where the money came from and what Betsy is doing, which is so both unconscionable and frankly immoral. Welcome.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. Real pleasure to get to be on here with you and learn a little bit more about New Hampshire and help you figure out this issue. So, you know, unfortunately, when it comes to federal money, it's wonky. And I don't want to cause any accidents if people are driving because they fall asleep. But the shortest version of this is that, you know, when the pandemic hit, you know, public schools confronted a number of challenges. One of them was simply making sure kids didn't go hungry, so that now they are having to, you know, send food around in buses and delivering it. You know, I just got a text, you know, before you came on, you know, reminding families Monday is meal pickup day, you know, for these low-income children. Then, of course, there's the issue of, well, these kids are at home. How are they going to learn? They need computers. They need Wi-Fi access. You know, I don't know what the Wi-Fi access is in rural communities in New Hampshire, but it's a real challenge in rural communities to even have it there. And then the expense of it in cities is huge. And then you have schools having to invest in sort of new platforms or new technologies to try to roll any learning out to the kids. So we've got these things going on. You've also got the obvious problem of falling state revenues, which we know is coming down the pipe. And so as part of the overall CARES Act, which, you know, handed out, you know, unemployment benefits and loans to private business, Congress put in money there to stabilize public schools, right? It's called the Education Stabilization Fund. And there's a few different buckets there, but the bucket that we're talking about was about $13.5 billion, which was not a big enough bucket, to be quite honest. But anyway, that's what Congress said. $13.5 billion in the CARES Act for public schools with low-income students. And so that money was supposed to be divided across the nation based upon how many low-income kids you have, and so we can make sure they, you know, fed all that. And the kicker in all this that you were getting at is that Betsy DeVos told the public schools that they needed to reserve an inordinate amount of that $13 billion for private school students. Now, on one level, that's not unusual. On one small level, which is if there are low-income students in the private schools who need resources, then the public schools are supposed to provide those and serve those students too. But most private schools only have about 5% low-income kids, so it doesn't amount to much money. What right. Betsy DeVos said is, no, we want you to reserve money not just for the 5% low-income kids, but for the entire private school population. So that's crazy. The other thing's crazy, which is the public schools only got money for poor kids. So what they're really saying is, take the money that we gave you for poor kids and share it with wealthy private school kids.
Well, as we were talking, I called a friend of mine this morning because I was rereading your article, and I reminded them that my little tiny state of New Hampshire with 1.3 million people in toto, so we're like the size of a suburb. But what do we have? We have the richest private school in the world, St. Paul's in Concord. We have Phillips Exeter. And I'm thinking, if they include private schools, what is considered a poor student at Phillips Exeter, their father probably owns Toyota. I mean, I want people to understand what this is, because this is just incredible at a time that everyone is hemorrhaging. I mean, a couple of maybe wealthy people may have lost something in the market, but trust me, that's not the same as losing your job or never having a job that actually even paid the bills before the pandemic. So what she's doing by diverting it is really placing a triple burden on public schools because she's sharing so much of this relatively small pot of money with people that really should never have access to it in the first place, but clearly don't have a need.
Well, yeah, I might also say you said trip. I mean, they are double dipping as well, because what the CARES Act had an enormous fund, which most people know quite a bit about, for private businesses to apply for the payroll protection program so that you could get money if you're a private business and you don't lay folks off. Well, these private schools, because they're private businesses, were eligible for those payroll protection plans to help stabilize their budgets. So not only are they getting that money, which, to be quite frank, is bigger than this poverty money for public schools, they're trying to grab money from the public schools, and some of them actually getting, you know, the payroll protection. So that really makes it quite obscene in my perspective.
So Professor Black, this was not the intent. The intent was low income. Betsy, of course, is able to sort of, well, I don't know if she's able, but she has chosen to manipulate how the money is to be spent. My question is, can it be challenged in court? What can Congress do? And frankly, does she have the authority? Because really the underlying premise is illegal because it violates the CARES Act, because the CARES Act said low income. And yes, low income students, 5%, may be in private school, but I'm sorry, but the head of Mitsubishi is not low income. It goes to maybe, you know, St. Paul's in Concord. So what I'm trying to figure out is, do you have to follow this? Can you say, screw you? Or do I have to wait for Congress to do something? Or can we go to court? Because this really is desperately needed money. More money than, I mean, people need every penny possible. And to divert any of it is absolutely wrong, especially at this time when more is needed, not less.
Yeah, that's right.
How you can challenge this? Can you go to federal court? Can you go to wait for Congress? Can you just ignore it and say, screw you, I'm not going to listen?
Yeah, so the answer to that is it's states don't have to follow this necessarily. I mean, we have the Indiana state superintendent who's already told her school districts, ignore it, it's not grounded in the law. My obligation is to follow the law, not follow Betsy DeVos. So, you know, kudos to her. And just to be clear, the law is so obvious on this. This isn't, in my mind, a political issue. This is a Republican state superintendent in the state of Indiana saying, we're not following Betsy DeVos's rules because we don't think the law matters, or that her interpretation matters. So I think, you know, that's option number one, because the last thing you want to do is fight this thing out in court. We'll get to that in a moment. But I would say to every state superintendent out there in the country who has a statutory and constitutional obligation to serve their children in their state and their public schools, for them to hand over money or reserve money for kids that is contrary to the CARES Act seems crazy to me. So they ought to just stand on the law and say, go take a hike, Betsy. We're not doing that.
Well,
now,
I want people to understand this. This is Indiana. It was a Republican head of education in Indiana who understood that the obligation was to serve public school kids. She read the CARES Act. She understood the intent of the CARES Act. She saw what Betsy was doing and said, that's fine, but it violates the CARES Act, and my obligation is to follow the law. You chose not to, but that doesn't mean that I have to choose not to, and therefore, no, I'm not going to do it. I mean, this is going to be my role model for 49 other states, especially my state of New Hampshire, but now it gives me a sort of a real sense of satisfaction that at least from a partisan perspective, the Republican in Indiana understood the obligation and the intent of this money, and that Betsy was violating that obligation and that intent.
Interestingly enough, what state is our vice president from?
Yeah, no, I know. That's why
it's sort of in his face, isn't it? So I wanted to ask you, Derek, is there anything that DeVos can do to make life difficult for Indiana public schools? You know, the way Trump is saying, let's not give any of the support money to blue states.
Yeah, so the tricky issue, and I mean, you know, Arnie had started out with it, you know, what is the sort of legal or litigation aspect of this? I don't want to get us down into sort of technical injury things, what qualifies, but there is the argument that Betsy can't do anything to them if they don't follow it. And if she can't do anything to them, then there's no real harm or injury. So how can they go into court and sue? I guess they could ask for declaratory relief to declare her to be wrong. But courts don't want to, like, waste their time correcting all the dumb stuff that, you know, some people in federal government say. So
not federal
courts. Yeah. So there is a question of whether she could.
Did she do some sort of regulatory rulemaking? I mean, was this just guidance from Betsy DeVos, or was it a regulation out of her? I want to know what form it took in order for Indiana to say,
Yeah. So it's guidance saying when you start. So first of all, the money goes to the state, then the state gives it to the districts, and then the states, then the school districts began to sort of divvy it up. And what she was saying is, hey, as you school districts begin to divvy it up, you ought to divvy it up this way. The reason why we're getting at this legal issue was there's no specific condition attached to them not doing what she says, which, again, I don't want to bore people or cause accidents over con law. But if there's no conditions for breaking the rules, then do you really have to follow them? What happens? And it's not clear what would happen here. And what I would say is, even if she wanted to, let's say, however, that Betsy gets mad and says, wait a minute, I told you to not spend that money, and you did it a different way, then probably Betsy would actually have to go into court and sue the school district.
Oh, I like that.
And then she would have to justify her position, which she wouldn't be able to. Right. So this is a really, on one level, arguably a lot of, if someone is brave enough, like the superintendent of Indiana, and talks to his or her general counsel, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on, because there's no way that Betsy DeVos is going to file suit against a school district claiming that they violated the CARES Act. I just don't see that happening, because that would be a frivolous lawsuit for her to do.
But here's the thing that really frightens me, is that then it could be an accident of political geography.
That's right.
I'm glad to see that the superintendent is a Republican and there's a Republican governor and was able to do this. But I suspect that that won't be true in Texas. I suspect that that won't be true in a lot of Southern states. I suspect, I think we can make a hissy fit in New Hampshire that we can shame Edelbluth and shame the governor so that they have to back off. Edelbluth's like in his glory. This is our commissioner of education. We have a Republican governor who appointed this Edelbluth guy who's a mini Betsy DeVos, but our Republican governor is surrounded by Democrats. I mean, there's like, he's the only standing Republican, okay, I'll just put it that way, and he's running for re-election. And at a time when we have the highest property taxes in the nation, and they're going to be hemorrhaging on top of all this, it just seems to me that even if it was a Republican governor, I don't know how they could do this and save face, because so many public schools are going to be such curtain puppies. And to see that this money is being diverted, you give some amazing numbers, you write. Because, and I want people to hear the numbers, because I don't know, did you do the calculation? How did you do the calculation for Mississippi? How did you do it? I want to know about the diversion. Like you mentioned, Montana's given this much money. They have to divert this much money to private schools under Betsy's plan. But normally they would have to, did you do the math? Because I want every state to be able to do the math and be able to show people and get the teachers union, get the school boards, get the superintendents to be outraged and say, we can't afford this money to be diverted to Phillips Exeter, to Choate, to whatever it is that you're going to be sending the money to.
Yeah. So when you ask the best slash worst question you could ask, which is in part that these numbers, people have been scrambling to pull them together on a sort of hour by hour basis. So you got the Education Law Center in New Jersey pulling together some data points. You got, you know, high state officials in Montana pulling together. You know, the New York Times, I think, was the one who had contacted Mississippi. You know, I've been scrambling to get some data here in South Carolina. And you go, wait a minute. Well, why are you scrambling to get data? The answer to this question actually shows how obscene her policy is. Because this has never been done in the history of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the local school district has no idea how many total kids go to Exeter. They care less. They're not responsible for those kids. Yeah. And for that matter, a lot of them don't even live in their districts. That's the other problem, which I've been talking to some of my colleagues with. You say, look, you know, here in Columbia, South Carolina, for instance, you say, you know, how many kids go to these elite, you know, private schools? Well, I don't know. We come up with a number, but do they actually live in Columbia? And the answer is no. A lot of them live in the suburbs. Some of them come 60, 70 miles away. So not only are we reserving money in Columbia for the wealthy private schools, we may be reserving them for kids who live two or three counties away. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, let me just give some of the numbers, just because you did do a little bit of math.
Sure.
This is why I was like apoplectic. And I want people to hear the numbers because it's really important. I think if I ever run for office again, my entire campaign will be do the math. Mm-hmm. That's my entire campaign. Because this is where you really see how horrific her policy is. In Passaic, New Jersey, where the majority of public school students are poor, the district will need to reserve $1.4 million instead of $300,000 for private school students. Can I repeat that, everyone? So they're going to have to reserve $1.4 million instead of $300,000. That just gives you an idea of how horrific this is. You then went to the entire state of Montana, and you wrote, Montana estimates it will need to reserve $1.5 million for private schools rather than $206,000. This is just, it's unbelievable. And I almost think that this is nuclear in a lot of ways. You know, Betsy thinks that she can do this and no one's going to make a big deal of it. And that, you know, thank God for the superintendent of Indiana. But I think in some ways, this almost reflects the immorality of it, which is, everyone, Republicans and Democrats, passed the CARES Act together. They jumped in and held hands. Everyone understood what the term low income meant. But look what the Trump administration, through the use of Betsy DeVos, is able to do, or thinks she's able to do, by manipulating the result. We already know big business gets too much money. We already know that a lot of small businesses were left out. They didn't have relationships with banks. Now, when it comes to students, look what they're doing. The exact same thing that we saw happening when it came to who got the money. When it was, you know, was it a successful company of $2 or $3 million versus a ma and pa sort of, you know, dry cleaner?
Well, let me just say one thing. Congress knows what's going on. So the HEROES Act that got passed on Friday out of Congress, I don't know what the final vote on that was. It actually had, but it did get passed in the House. It, you know, who knows what will happen in the Senate, but it actually had a specific provision in it saying, look, Betsy, if you couldn't read the CARES Act, let's tell you again, you can't do that. I mean, obviously it's not the literal language, but you know, folks know what's going on. You know, we've got Representative Scott from Virginia, who chairs the Education Committee. And I know that he's on top of this. And now I want to make a pitch, which is, I hope a staffer in the governor's office or a staffer in one of your senator's offices is listening or know someone who's listening who can call them. Because I can tell you, earlier this spring, and this was important in New Hampshire and it was very important to Maine, she changed a calculation in terms of how you hand out money for rural schools. There was a program, been around for decades. She said, well, we're not going to calculate it that way. We're going to calculate it a different way. You know, most of your big power players don't live in small rural areas. They miss it. But Susan Collins' office got hold of it. And Susan Collins was hot. It was going to affect a number of schools in Maine. And she called, you know, Betsy DeVos to the mattresses. And what do you know? Betsy DeVos actually reversed her policy earlier this year. Ooh. When Collins called her on this. And so my hope here is, you know, Betsy is so far afield of what the law requires that if just a couple of Republican senators will look and see what this is doing to poor kids and in their large cities, all they need to do is send a letter or get someone from the Education Committee. Get, you know, Collins on the Education Committee, Lamar Alexander's on the Education Committee. Say, hey, Betsy, you know, what's up? Because the law says X and you're doing Y. I mean, you know, this isn't a policy debate. The law has been passed. It requires A, you're doing B. That's my hope, so that we don't get in this geographic problem that you were describing earlier.
Right. Well, Derek, you're talking on the right station. And the reason I say that is our show airs on KPFT in Houston, Texas. And I believe there are two Republican senators that represent the great state of Texas. I know there was a big push in Texas, because we cover Texas all the time, about property taxes and the funding of public education. I suspect that someone might hear you. So, you know, Ted Cruz might be getting a phone call. Cornyn is running for re-election. This will be a big issue for him if someone calls him up and publicly sort of says, what are you doing about this? If Senator Cornyn wants to win his reelection, I suspect he should call Betsy DeVos. So I'm just telling you.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a red or blue issue.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, it's not.
You know, 90% of our country's children go to public schools. And regardless of whether they're Republicans in Indiana or Democrats in New Jersey or wherever, right? I mean, all these people, regardless of political party, are charged with serving our public school children. The governors are responsible for their school. There is not two sides to this issue other than, well, there's Betsy DeVos and there's everyone else. And maybe a few, you know, voucher lobbyists, you know, around the edges. But other than that, this is a one-way issue. And I just think that
it's an important issue because there wasn't even enough for education. With $13.5 billion, this isn't even enough. And let's remember, this is just for now. As we're looking at opening schools in the fall, I want to remind everyone, it is going to be double the cost. Because now they're going to have to accommodate the pandemic. And that means they're going to need smaller classrooms. That means that they're not going to have to wash everything down. That means they may have to work double time. You know, some kids come in on one day, some kids come on another day. There's going to be such an additional financial burden, and more kids are going to require food because their parents still are unemployed. So there's going to be even more money going into these schools in order for them to feed kids, let alone educate them. So I just want people to know, you don't divert now, God help you, because you're going to need so much more in the fall. Derek Black, we're calling you a lot. I'm telling you right now. He teaches at the University of South Carolina Law School. Go to theconversation.com or go to my Facebook page, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. The title of the piece, Giving Private Schools Federal Emergency Funds Slated for Low-Income Students Will Shortchange At-Risk Kids. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. A lot of fun.
It was great.
Thanks.
All right, everyone, care, stick around. When we come back, let's see, what are we talking about? Oh, we're talking about socialists. I love it. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, growing seasons are becoming more erratic. That uncertainty makes it harder for farmers to decide when to plant and harvest crops. David Abbas is a farmer in northeastern Minnesota.
We cannot rely, May 1st, we plant lettuce. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
So instead, Abbas is basing his decisions on natural signs of seasonal change, like when robins arrive in spring, the marsh marigold first flowers, or snow buntings migrate. He's matched up records of those natural events with 30 years of his own planting and harvest data. That's allowed him to see which events are good signposts.
So when the dandelion flowers, we might be planting potatoes and transplanting lettuce.
After a few years of experimenting, Abbas has created a site-specific farming calendar based solely on natural events. This year, he plans to rely on that instead of traditional dates. He's optimistic that the approach will help him maintain good harvests in a changing climate. And he says the process has been rewarding in other ways, too.
It forces me to observe. And what's better for farming than for a farmer to be observant?
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
How many socialists we got out there today? Come on, let's see a show of left hand. You drive here on a public street. Socialist. You go to a public school.
Yes.
Socialist. You ever visit a public library? Why? I'll tell you why, because you're a socialist. Like Ulysses S. Grant. Yellowstone National Park. You ever been there? Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Teddy Pinko Roosevelt. That guy was talking about universal health care. You're taxing, appropriating, regulating, nanny state, and socialist. You ever mail a letter? Of course you have, because you're a socialist. Like Dwight D. Eisenhower. He built highways between the states. Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Richard Red Diaper Nixon. He put food stamps on people's plates. You're a taxing, appropriating, regulating, nanny state, socialist.
Welcome back to Parle Deux of the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is the Tuesday edition. So, Atlantic Monthly, I'm getting it for years. I see a piece and I'm thinking, oh, did Bernie write this? It was entitled, Thousands of Americans Have Become Socialists Since March. The Democratic Socialists of America have an estimated 10,000 new members, growth that organizers attribute in part to the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us right now is Elaine Godfrey. She is the writer and someone who hails from the great state of Iowa, which we are very intimate with, Elaine. And I read this and in fact, I started to smile. I said, what? They don't like crony capitalism? I don't understand, you know? They're complaining about the pandemic. I was complaining before the pandemic. So welcome to the program, Elaine.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so tell us about this story. I'm kind of curious, you know, for the longest time, you couldn't even say you were a liberal. Then they said, okay, we'll change the word from liberal to progressive, since liberal was like a bad word. And now we're going from, it's okay to say liberal. It's wicked okay to say progressive. I mean, everybody is saying progressive now. And now it appears that saying the word socialist, you know, where you couldn't even sort of publicly admit it, may not be such a bad thing. It sounds like it's a great time to say, hey, I'm a card-carrying socialist.
Yeah, it's a great time. I mean, especially for a certain age group, right? For people under the age of 40, this word has not nearly as many or as much negative connotation as it does for older people. In the last 2 months, the DSA has added 10,000 new members. And usually it's something, you know, usually in 2 months they might add 1,500 members. And so they're attributing this partly to Bernie Sanders dropping out of the race, and a lot of organizers and passionate Bernie folks saying, okay, what do I do with my energy now? And going to DSA, which is what happened in 2016 as well. But this is such a huge increase that they said it also has to be the coronavirus pandemic. You have all these people who are joining who have been recently laid off. You have healthcare workers joining who are upset about the status of their working conditions, about their payment. Yeah, I mean, the moment feels particularly ripe for socialist outrage.
Well, there's a couple of things. Since we both know Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State, I'm going to bring him up because Stefan just sent me an email. I mean, we send emails to each other all the time. And he was talking about the single payer systems that had failed. And he's talking about the weaknesses of the single payer in Canada and the weaknesses of the single payer in whatever. So in a lot of ways, his drumbeat is, see, that socialist healthcare still failed. And what is so interesting to me, Elaine, is that, you know, a pandemic, I think, is harmful to everyone, no matter what kind of healthcare system you have. But what's been so interesting, and I think may also attribute to the rise of people being willing to look at socialism in part because they're looking at a different form of healthcare, which is a healthcare you see in places where it's universal, which is something that's more socialistic, is that even in the countries where the pandemic sort of really seemed to not be able to be addressed successfully, what they didn't have were people with so many underlying conditions, because forever they never had access to the healthcare system. Forever they were either underinsured or uninsured, or in a place where it was, you know, difficult to find a doctor who would serve you because you had a Medicaid card. So what I think is so interesting about this idea of people signing up because of the pandemic is that all of a sudden now you see all the rot of the system, and it's not just our inability to address people's health, it's our inability to feed people, to shelter people, to get people the healthcare they need, because the system has been so topsy-turvy where so much of our wealth went to the top 1% and the rest of us got to share the crumbs.
Yeah, someone that I talked to in the piece, it's one of my opening quotes of the piece, said, I thought capitalism was supposed to ensure that we had enough masks and that we had enough cotton swabs and that we had enough ventilators, XYZ, you know, life-saving tools. Maybe capitalism isn't working. And I that's, people told me that over and over again, even people who previously, like you said, did not identify as socialists. They were liberal or progressive, but they weren't, you know, card-carrying red rose socialists. They were just, you know, the system works fine. And then they sort of came to this new realization in April, or, you know, when they lost their job, or when they tried to file for unemployment and the line was busy and they just couldn't do it. I think DSA has really filled a role for a lot of those people.
So I've been talking about this a lot. And that is, you know, so Bernie talks about the fact that he's a democratic socialist. And I believe AOC describes herself that way. And so we have a couple of elected officials around the country. Can you define socialists for me? And the reason I say that is I have been banging this drum. And that is, I went to school at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. And a lot of the people that attended school there are of Norwegian extraction. And there were a lot of Norwegians that attended school there. So I have a lot of friends that live in Norway. And so it's what's so interesting to me is the Norwegians don't describe themselves as socialists. The Swedes don't describe themselves as socialists. So all the socialists that, you know, Bernie refers to don't even describe themselves as socialists. They describe themselves as compassionate capitalists. Mm-hmm. Or the Nordic model. So I am kind of curious, how do these DSA people describe socialism? What is their socialism like? Is it like Norway? Is it like Sweden that doesn't say it's a socialist? Or are they back to the old school of when Bernie was, you know, first describing socialism, something that was a little more the idea that there wasn't an opportunity for, you know, for someone to become a billionaire, for example, socialist countries would not permit that. They would be sort of contained. I'm kind of curious how they define socialism. Is it a new definition or is it more of the older definition?
So DSA is a huge tent. So it just depends on the person that you talk to. So, you know, I did this big story I guess it was almost a year ago now, where I talked to self-described socialists in Iowa specifically, wanting to see if it's different there, if they define it differently than Brooklyn socialists.
Yeah, good.
And some people do. Some people say, I'm a social democrat. I think workers should be given priority over corporations. You know, they definitely talk about the Nordic model. But then you also have people who say, no, all forms of capitalism are bad and wrong, and we need to overthrow them, and workers should control the means of production and all of this stuff. So, I mean, it's definitely a range. I think it's easy to have such a big tent when the U.S. doesn't really have a social democrat party to be the define it, I guess, right, to be the standard bearer, like it does in, you know, in Europe. I mean,
so it's more of a smorgasbord that it's not so it isn't defined sort of in a more tight way, and you can sort of understand that. One of the things I got from your article at The Atlantic, again, let me remind everyone, Elaine Gotry wrote this piece, Thousands of Americans Have Become Socialists Since March, and in part because of the coronavirus pandemic. But what I also get is that they're also seeing this as an opportunity for them. That what the pandemic has done is a horrific thing to the economy, horrific thing to people's health, and frankly, their mental health. And yet this is both an opportunity for them to begin to sort of push a lot of the agenda that they believe in. That also turns out to be fact, it's been marbleized throughout the Democratic Party. I mean, you're beginning to hear people like Joe Biden say healthcare is a right. I mean, the first time he said it, I almost had cardiac arrest. I'm like, it's a right? Oh, good. We're moving in the right direction. So do they see this as a way to continue to sort of not just build numbers, but using their voice, give us a spectrum so that we can move more to a more progressive, democratic, socialist, whatever you want to call it, agenda, because this is their time?
Yes, 100%.
Okay.
They are taking this opportunity to both recruit members and build up their ranks, but also just to show this is what socialism is. They're trying to say socialism is organizing struggling workers. In Denver, for example, they're organizing laid off service workers. They have mutual aid projects. So they're giving them food assistance. They're raising money for each other. And then they're doing the next step of organizing them and putting pressure on the city council to do a cancel rent campaign. So they're hoping to have some sort of legislative effect. In the bailout packages, they're hoping to have influence on those. They're hoping to say, let's not bail out corporations. Let's give, you know, small businesses and individual workers a lot more money. There in Minneapolis, there's a big hazard pay push for healthcare workers. There's organization to get people PPE. Like the socialists are actually negotiating for PPE for nurses in Minneapolis.
I love it. And you know what I got from your article? Before, you would not want to publicly admit that you were hanging out with socialists. But now you got teachers unions hanging out with socialists. You got farmers hanging out. It's like, it's now become acceptable to be able to say that you are working in conjunction with them. It is not a stigma. It is not a negative. It's just enhancing your numbers. And also because they are part of the group, what they are saying in a way gives you some cover to say some of the things you want, because they've really changed the spectrum of conversation.
That's totally right. And people told me time and again, people really want to work with us right now. Yes. You know, BSA members, like, they're not used to people being excited to collaborate with them, but they have this special power in this moment. And I think, yeah, they are absolutely trying to take advantage of it and to wield whatever power they can as we, you know, go into this massive government spending that we might have to have. To get out of this recession, DSA is trying to really play a big role in that.
Okay, Ken?
Thanks. Could I just add one perspective? And I think Bernie Sanders deserves a great deal of credit for this increase in interest in socialism, and especially for the increased acceptability of saying, yeah, socialist ideas aren't so bad. You know, here's this guy who is saying, I am a socialist. That's who I am. You know, he minces no words about it. He doesn't go into hiding. It's not like the McCarthy era where he has
to say,
he's never apologized for it. And we've seen him up close and personal. And you know what? He doesn't have horns. He's not evil. He's not a raving maniac. He's not Joseph Stalin. He's not running us over with tanks. His ideas are just the same as unions and working people have been saying. It's very similar to what FDR was saying in the 30s. You know, let's make people the priority and not profits.
Well, and Elaine, I think the other thing that I also got from your article too, and I keep thinking about this, and Ken's right about, you know, Bernie's never apologized for who he is. I mean, that's, and there's, and as he grew through that campaign of 2016, the ideas that he was talking about were ideas that were resonating. I mean, when you have young people who have, you know, more student debt than credit card debt, they're beginning to say, yeah, free college may not be a bad idea. I don't want to be an indentured servant for 30 years, you know? I mean, so, and when you look at climate change, you look at the Green New Deal, I mean, why are we bailing out oil companies and coal companies when they're destroying the planet and we're not investing in solar? I mean, there are so many obvious reasons, and the connection between the term socialism and healthcare is interesting. The connection between socialism and the Green New Deal and fighting climate change is interesting. So socialists really now have a real opportunity, because when you say that word, what comes into your head is not Stalin or Lenin, it's a solar panel or a geothermal. You know, it's being able to go to a doctor and not having to pay a copay. I mean, it's so fascinating, because they now actually control people's headset in a way they never were able to before.
Yeah, that's totally right. And I think socialism and the priorities of a group like DSA are the only thing that young people, that many young people have been able to find and join that matches their level of frustration and that offers solutions for them, like that the Democratic Party just hasn't, that someone like Joe Biden just hasn't. And I think this is a really interesting moment, especially for this these task forces that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders have set up together to, you know.
With AOC on one of the task forces, you know, exactly. AOC is a Democratic Socialist. I mean, she's part, isn't she a card-carrying member? I believe
she is. She's a member, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, and again, think about this, everyone. Biden has a card-carrying socialist as part of this sort of team that surrounds him. This is like unbelievable, Elaine. They must have died and gone to heaven when that happened. It's like, oh my God. But you know, as I'm thinking about this, again, what has happened in the United States, and I've always said this, is that as the Democrats became more like Republicans, with the new Democrats that were more like moderate Republicans, you know, they wanted to hold hands with Wall Street. They said the era of big government is over. Thank you, Bill Clinton. They got rid of, you know, Glass-Steagall. I always describe the Bill Clinton years as a Republican wet dream. You know, I mean, they couldn't get any of these things through, but it was a Democrat that delivered everything the Republicans had ever wanted on crime, on welfare, on the controls of finance. I mean, think about it. So what happened was the spectrum basically went to the right. And what is now happening, and in part because, not because of Barack, but because of Bernie, we now have a real spectrum of conversation, which means the middle is more real. It stopped being the middle. It was off to the right. It wasn't the middle. And I think what socialists probably can take heart in is two statistics that I use all the time. I was doing Fox News a couple of months ago, and we were being challenged about issues like raising the minimum wage. And I said, do you realize that every time the minimum wage has been on a ballot by referendum, it is passed in both red states and blue states, Elaine. Even when every single elected official comes out against raising the minimum wage, when people voted in those red states, they voted for it. That is a description of what socialists are talking about, is when people are actually told, would you want this? Guess what? They probably do.
Mm-hmm. And Bernie Sanders can take a lot of credit for this window shifting, and for just changing, just, you know, a whole generation of minds have been changed, or at least, you know, opened to the possibility. Yeah, of course.
Now tell us a little bit about, I mean, there are some people too that have gotten elected. I mean, I'm not just talking about AOC in Congress. I'm talking about that there have been some city councilors that have gotten elected. I believe in Seattle, I think it is, in a couple. And they have actually made, again, a difference. You know, people keep thinking that, you know, if I elect this person, what's the big deal? They'll be one of 12 people. Or they'll be one. But just having that voice and providing that spectrum can actually produce change even at a city council level or even at a state legislative level, because they're now unafraid of sharing those ideas, and suddenly you find out those ideas have legs.
Right, and suddenly you find out that those ideas aren't, you know, necessarily so scary.
Exactly.
You have this Seattle, I'm blanking on her name now.
No, I am blanking on her name too, but I see her in my head and I know it was Seattle, but we can keep going. We don't need her name.
She's the pride and joy of the DSA right now because she's, you know, she, it's relatively small scale. It's a city council, but it's Seattle. It is a real model for what DSA wants to do around the country, is elect these local leaders and really practice grassroots politics, like really work their way up from this local level. Because I think the point is to build goodwill in communities, to show people this is what it is, right? People are broadly supportive of a lot of the things that the socialists talk about, you know, whether you call yourself that or not. And I think that that's the role, definitely, of these local leaders.
Well, I think if I'm correct, and it's been a while since I've had to discuss this, but my understanding is that she's like one of the people that raised the idea of the living wage and raised the wages in Seattle and did a lot of the things where, and let me just say one of the reasons why that she is their darling. And she has been relatively successful despite the fact she's one of many, but I mean, one person on the city council, but she happens to be a socialist. But here's where I know as a former legislator, why seeing what she's doing in Seattle is so important, because good ideas clone. And what that means is that there may not be a socialist in New Jersey, and there may not be a socialist on the city council in Virginia, but they can point to what Seattle passed. They can point to Seattle's experience. They can say, look at how it worked. Look at how it brought the bottom up. Businesses didn't flee. It didn't, all the stuff you've been told that will happen did not happen. We can do it too. So I just want to remind everyone that you don't need 10% or 20% of the Democrats to being socialists. You just need a handful that can show that something can pass. And then you have the concrete example of this good idea working. And now the question is, can you replicate it? And now no one points to that it was a socialist in Seattle. What you do is go, look what Seattle did. And of course, she's smiling because she knows she was the mover and shaker.
Right.
That's, oh, my God.
That's right.
Yeah, Ken.
Well, I was going to add that in addition, that's a very valid point, and I really like that idea of cloning the
good ideas,
the progressive ideas that have made a positive change. But in addition, the message of socialist thinking is consistent with what Bernie and Elizabeth Warren have been saying, and many people before them. I mean, God knows Walter Mondale lost in 1984 because of that, the Reagan, but. Talking about Wall Street as the problem and big profits and big corporations that get, they're the ones that get corporate welfare. The government takes money from rich donors and makes policy, federal policy that helps big corporations and rich people. And the rest of us, the regular working stiffs, get screwed. And that kind of what Republicans then say, you're making a class war out of it. And that's what Marx said, of course, too. But that issue, and Bernie and Elizabeth have made that an issue that is resonating with a lot of young people, and now with the pandemic, with a lot of people who are not young.
All right, so Elaine, let's sober this conversation up. How many libertarians are there in the United States, and how many socialists are there right now? I mean, I want to come to Jesus moment here, because I want people to know the numbers again, it's still teeny tiny.
Yep. Definitely. So there are 66,000 registered members, dues-paying members in the DSA, and there are 600,000 registered members of the Libertarian Party.
I know. I'm going to give you my claim to fame, Elaine. You ready for this?
Yes.
My second husband was a Libertarian atheist Republican. This is my absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And everyone's like, I cannot believe you married a Libertarian. So here's the good news, Elaine. He voted for Bush the first time. He didn't vote for Bush the second time. So my theory of the case is if I had slept around enough, we would never have had Bush the second time. Because if I can transform a Libertarian, I can transform anyone. So it's just, but the reason I say that is that what socialists and progressives can point to are policies that help people. If Libertarians don't believe in government, basically say no to everything, they can point to nothing. They can point to nothing. Because if they have dismantled the safety net, they have dismantled government, they've said you're on your own, Jack, and we're suddenly realizing because of pandemics, you can't be on your own. Because of climate change, you can't be on your own. Because of a flood, you can't be on your own. The Libertarians, I think, can have 600,000 people follow them, but they can't point to success. And what I think you saw happening in Seattle is that what she was able to do is point to success. And success clones and it grows people. So it was a great article. You better keep writing about this. I wanna know how many people are gonna join by November of 2020.
I wanna know too. I'll be keeping track.
I know. It'll be interesting. And they really are actively seeking out people. I mean, are they trying to recruit? Are people knocking on their door? I'm just trying to figure out whether they've been aggressive or people are like, I am fed up and I'm finding this crowd.
No, well, I think it's probably a mix, but I think they're actively recruit. Well, I know they're actively recruiting. I know if you get laid off and DSA finds out about it, they give you a call and they say, can we help you with anything? Do you want to start coming to meetings? What are you angry about? Mm-hmm. They are actively out there.
Wow. And who has the largest group of socialists? Which state can the claim to fame that has the highest percentage?
That's a good question.
Has to be New York.
You didn't ask that question?
Has to be New York City.
Not by numbers. It's not fair. If it's New York City, it's not fair. I'm sort of curious to know where there are pockets of them, because that would really sort of also tell me where they have that critical mass. And from that critical mass, things can grow. It'll be really interesting. And I suspect that they're probably having a really lovely relationship with unions that have been dying for so long. And if there's a natural sort of relationship, it would be with unions, because unions understand getting screwed and that they need to sort of work together in order to bring fairness into the workplace. And that's exactly what socialists talk about.
Yeah, and that's definitely happening.
I just want to say that Kashama Sawant is the name of the city council member.
Thank you so much.
She's a
Maybe we're going to have to interview her. We'll have to interview her next, Elaine. I'll blame you for that interview.
Her party is the Socialist Alternative.
Oh, I love it. And on that note, thank you so much. I'm just, now that everyone knows that I married a libertarian, I hope they continue to listen to me. thousands of Americans have become socialists since March. Elaine Godfrey, you're a charming, delightful person. I'm glad you're writing for The Atlantic.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Joe. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll chat tomorrow.
You're the boot stomping on the human face forever. You're the eye staring down on everyone. Never seeing all, you're the lie, twisting all our minds into your whoredom. You were death, you were war, you were slavery. You're the law, you're the law, you're the law. When lost, you like vomit from power drunk tongues. The power of-